cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Carol Messer along with Tim Stenebeck breaking down the Apple story. I believe it's still our most read story on the Bloomberg in the past 60 minutes. We want to get more on the suit, what it means. It was filed today in a New Jersey federal court. What it is, what it's all about, what could be the potential impact legally and maybe on the business at Apple. With us right now is Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Antitrust Litigation Analyst Jennifer Ree. She is with us in New York City. Hey, Jen, good to have you here with Tim and myself. All right, lay it out for us. What exactly is this suit all about?
Well, you know, this was so widely anticipated. And as expected, the Department of Justice in these states are alleging that Apple has a monopoly. And they're saying a monopoly in two different markets. One, a broad market for smartphones, and a second one, a narrower market, which is a market for what they call performance smartphones. In other words, the more expensive end of the market. And that it uses its control over all the technologies that are needed for any kind of functionality on the iPhone in a way that locks in users, makes it much harder for them to switch to a non-Apple smartphone. And then that protects its monopolies and continues to allow it to charge high prices, you know, wherever it's charging a fee for the use of the phone. And it does this in a number of ways, by prohibiting apps that would make it easier for users to switch, or by, let's say, once somebody buys an expensive smartwatch, making it so that smartwatch isn't really going to work with a non-Apple iPhone. And so you've bought the watch, you're going to hang on to the iPhone and you're not going to switch. Things like that. They lay out a couple different examples of the ways that Apple has sort of degraded different technologies or prevented technologies from being on the phone that would keep people in its own ecosystem.
Critics to the suit might say, well, wait a second. Apple's just making sure that the Apple ecosystem is as user-friendly as possible, and the products work best when working with Apple, other Apple products. Let's set that aside for 1 second, Jen, and get into the idea. What's the Justice Department and what are the attorneys general looking for in this suit?
Well, you know, they haven't asked really outright for any kind of a structural remedy as they have in their lawsuits against Google. They are asking for injunctive relief, you know, not fees. That's not usually what happens in monopolization suits, but injunctive relief that really would crack open Apple's walled garden. They're really asking for an order that Apple provides more interoperability with some of these other technologies that would be beneficial, according to the DOJ, for users.
All right. When you look at a case like this, I feel like big tech has certainly been under regulators and certainly the U.S. Justice Department's radar over the last couple of decades, since that, you know, big tech has kind of rose to play such a big role in our society and has increasingly had a lot more power, if you will, in terms of what we are all doing. So how do you kind of legally game this out? Is it going to be a long court process? Does it feel like the justice has a stronger case? Does Apple have a good kind of rebuttal to it? How do you game it out?
I think this is a difficult case for the Department of Justice, just at least right now. I mean, let's first start with what you just said. This is going to be a really long process. I mean, 3 years, I think, at the least, before you have at least a district court decision. The whole market could change with generative AI and all the different new technologies that are emerging. You know, the market could be quite different by the time a decision needs to be made. So that's one thing. The second thing is that the DOJ really tries to align this with a case in which it was successful against Microsoft in the 1990s. But there are kind of some big differences, because at that time, Microsoft's monopoly over the operating system was really solid. And here you have Android, and you can't say that Android's not a significant competitor. And I think that there are some weaknesses in the way they've defined the market. To say that there's this segment of smartphones allows them to say that in the US, Apple has a 75% market share. And they kind of have to do that in order to establish monopoly power. And I'm not really sure that that's a market definition that would hold up. And the last thing I want to say goes back to something Tim just said, in that it's very difficult to prove monopolization where a company has legitimate pro-competitive business justifications for its conduct. Now, here the DOJ says that Apple's justifications, you know, more efficient use of privacy, security, seamless operation of Apple products are pretexts, right? That the, the documents and the testimony won't bear that out. But, you know, we've already seen in another case against Apple by Epic Games, a lot of that evidence fleshed out, and a judge in that case decided that Apple did have pro-competitive justifications for its walled garden. And a lot of the same evidence will be put on trial here. So I think that there are weaknesses, and it remains to be seen, you know, what the evidence really says. Of course, the DOJ takes excerpts from documents that look bad for Apple, but you need to see the totality of the facts and the totality of the evidence to really understand the intent and motivation behind some of the conduct that's outlined here.
Hey, Jennifer, I do want to just read Apple's statement that they sent to Bloomberg News that actually addresses some of what you just talked about. Quote, at Apple, we innovate every day to make technology people love, designing products that work seamlessly together, protecting people's privacy and security, and create a magical experience for users. This lawsuit threatens who we are and the principles that set Apple products apart in fiercely competitive markets. As you mentioned, Jen, there have been other lawsuits in the past few years, specifically about Apple's App Store and the take rate at Apple's App Store. To what extent can we draw a line from that lawsuit and what's happened since then to what we learned today from the Justice Department and the Attorneys General?
Some of the differences here, you know, the Epic Games against Apple lawsuit was quite different. The markets alleged were different. And the main failure in that suit by the plaintiffs was really in the way they define the market. This market is defined differently, I think on purpose, because of the failure in that lawsuit. And it stands a bit on more solid ground. But, you know, the very interesting thing when I saw Apple's statement and what it made me think about is the judge in that Epic case who said, look, what you're asking for, Epic, is to make Apple iOS just like Android. Because Android is more open. It is less of a walled garden. And people sometimes choose Apple because they want that choice. They want the more closed off choice that they believe provides more privacy and more security. And if you force Apple to open up, you're really removing choice rather than giving users more choice. And, you know, I think about that. And that's one way to look at this situation and one way a judge might look at this situation. So really, you know, it sort of goes both ways, the walled garden versus the non-walled garden.
Bottom line, I'm thinking our investing audience that's listening here on Bloomberg, on TV, radio, YouTube, on streaming, across our platform. So we're watching Apple shares, they're down. They know, we know it's been a very different tone of trade, though, for Apple this year. We've seen that stock really pull off its highs, if you will. Having said that, you say difficult for justice, a case that could be 3 years, and then in 3 years, who knows where we are. So what do you think should be top of mind for investors, just quickly?
I think that, exactly that, that time will tell and that there should be no conclusions drawn now. There can't be. And Apple has a good shot here.
All right. Really appreciate it, as always. Jen Rhee, she is our senior antitrust litigation analyst. Unbelievable here at Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us from New York City. All right. So watching Apple, we're also, of course, keeping an eye on shares of Reddit. They're up about 42%, Tim.
Yeah. Shares of Reddit surging just in their first day of trading, pricing shares in an IPO at the top of marketed range. It's the second big tech listing in as many days. Our coverage of Reddit's IPO continues with Bloomberg News senior executive editor for global technology, Tom Giles, who's in our D.C. bureau. this afternoon, along with Ryan Bean, Ryan Gould, US IPO and deals reporter at Bloomberg News here in our New York studio. Hey, Tom, I do want to start with you, just wrapping up the conversation that we just had with Jen with Apple. To what extent do you think this is a threat to Apple as we know it, Apple's identity as it sees itself as this walled garden, this ecosystem that works seamlessly with other Apple products?
You know, that is a big selling point for them, and I think you see it every day when you use their products. They're going to probably have to make some changes in the way they do things, the way you interface with their services on the iPhone and other devices. I think they're going to throw some remedies at the Justice Department and try to work things out, try to reach a settlement. As was noted in the earlier conversation, this is going to take years to play out. I think the bigger thing that Apple needs to be thinking about is what is that next big product? And will the Vision Pro take off? I think those are the bigger existential questions facing Apple at the moment. This one, I have a feeling they're going to find ways to get to remedy it without changing their fundamental identity.
All right. Hey, speaking of existential questions, how are you, Tom Giles? Someone who has seen many tech cycles, understands the ups and downs of this industry, the changes that we see. Reddit, you know, it's been around for almost 20 years, 18 years or so. Social media player, how are you thinking about its existence in today's environment and as a business going forward?
Yeah, you know, it's been a long time since we saw a company, consumer internet company, sell shares to the public. There was a lot of pent-up demand. I think in this one, there's going to be conversations around whether the investment bankers left a little money on the table with the pricing of those shares. Look, it's popular. It's got a really loyal, a rabidly loyal fan base. Also, a fan base that's a user base, excuse me, that's liable to turn on it as well. Right now, it looks like things are going in their favor, and I think the other thing that people are looking at with regard to Reddit is not just the advertising business model, but this idea of them licensing their data to makers of large language models to train them and to make them better. Tools like ChatGPT, you can use the conversations and the original content that is created on Reddit to make your large language models more comprehensive, smarter, more in touch with what people are thinking and doing and posting. And Reddit wants to make a big business out of that. And I think that's part of what might be driving driving the stock today.
Well, speaking of the stock, I do want to bring in Ryan Gould, US IPO and deals reporter here at Bloomberg News. He's in our New York studio right now. So Ryan, talk a little bit about this IPO, because shares were sold at the top end of the marketed range, $34 yesterday. Bankers on a day like today, pretty happy with the way things are going?
For sure, Tim. I think this is a moment that the IPO market writ large has been waiting for probably the best part of 2 years, because we've had two tech IPOs in a week, both of which have either traded at the top of the range or above the range, and both of which have since gone on to trade, you know, substantially higher. If you look at Astera Labs, which just, you know, a couple of days ago priced in New York, I mean, this is really an IPO that has it all, right? Mm-hmm. It has AI, it's chips,
so true.
It's everything you could want as a banker. And, you know, to their credit, Morgan Stanley was the lead left on both Reddit and Astera Labs. I mean, I think, you know, Morgan Stanley, hats off, looks to have done a pretty good job, you could say, with both of these offerings. Now, obviously, there's a lot still to be done when it comes to Reddit.
Were they hankering to get this out, though, already? For Reddit in particular, 2 years in the making?
I think so. But I think you also have to put it on the shoulders of the company as well, because, you know, when you're Reddit, I think Jen Wong, the COO, was on BTV this morning talking about, you know, how this has been 2 years in the making. And I think for a company like Reddit, you just need to be able to push past it. It's a milestone. She said it was a wedding day for the company. Mm. And, you know, you can go on and be a married couple, hopefully for many years after the wedding day. But I think that the point being that they've spent so long in the quagmire of the uncertainty around tech, around IPOs, around what markets mean. And now you have a point that, like, okay, we've done it. We've crossed the line. The Rubicon is behind us.
But as we know, the honeymoon can be over really quickly in any relationship. Reddit share still up 45%, $49 and change. Tom Giles, come on back in here. It's something we talked about in our last hour. You know, being a publicly held company brings certain demands with it and a lot more scrutiny. So it's a tougher, you know, I understand the AI play and the data play makes sense, but it's a different environment for Reddit versus being private.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you have investors looking for near-term returns. When the user base gets angry about something and walks out, blacks out certain channels, those things will, you know, users or investors will be paying much more closer attention to things like that, hiccups along those lines. At the same time, Reddit, it's really incumbent on Reddit to demonstrate that these new business models like licensing your data will be able to generate money over the long haul, not just in the near term. How many different LLMs are going to need to license Reddit's data? Mm-hmm. Is that really sustainable over the long haul? It's a question that I don't know the answer to. It's a question we are asking. The other thing that they've got to do is they want to make money from services sold between users.
Right.
So one user sells a service to another, and Reddit keeps a cut of that. We know less about that business. I think that's less well developed than the other two. But they're going to have to continue to roll out things like that in order to keep investors, you know, and in order to keep that revenue coming in,
right,
and keeping investors happy.
Hey, Ryan, I want to give you the last word in the 30 seconds that we have left here. Did they price the IPO too low, do you think?
I don't think so. I think it was a moment to be cautious. I mean, markets are markets, right? Like, you would have to have a crystal ball to actually realize if Reddit was going to go up or down today, the big swing factor being the retail component.
Right.
It looks as though that's working in their favor.
8%, sure, right, of Reddit users got
exactly
to 8%
this. Of shares of the directed share program went towards, you know, Redditors.
All right. Fascinating. Stock's still up 42%. Guys, thank you so much. Ryan Gould, US IPO and deals reporter here in studio. Tom Giles, senior executive editor for Global Technology, both at Bloomberg News.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, the KBW Bank Index extending Wednesday's Fed-fueled risk-on gains, rising as much as 2.5% in early trading before paring some of those gains, up nearly 1.4% right now. The index, Carol, touched the highest since March of last year. That, of course, was when the whole sector was in turmoil.
So much was going on. For a check on regional banks and really more broadly the economy, let's bring in Jill Castilla. She is Citizens Bank of Edmond president and CEO, also a U.S. Army veteran who held various posts at the Kansas City Fed. She joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Jill, so nice to have you here with Tim and myself. A lot to get to. Talk to us, though, first about the Fed and how you were thinking about the meeting yesterday, because I think there's some analysis that they maybe they're kind of dragging their feet when it comes to making some rate cuts. How do you see it based against the business environment that you also see at your bank?
I mean, speaking from just what I'm seeing on Main Street, the economy seems to be still very strong. Mm-hmm. Our lending activity is robust. We're still seeing great CRE still activity in Middle America, even though we're having some stress.
Commercial real estate.
Deposits have stabilized. Net interest margins kind of across the 4,000 banks like mine is starting to also stabilize. It was compressing pretty rapidly, and deposit pricing is now kind of more stable. But loan volume is there. Economy seems really, really chugging along quite well. And I think we've seen consistent messaging from the Fed that they're going to be really data driven. And the data is showing, you know, that the economy is doing quite well.
Any signs of stress that you're seeing from your customers at all right now?
And we finished the year with zero past dues, zero non-accruals, and zero classified loans. Never in the history of our institution have we had those types of numbers.
How would you have answered that question a year ago?
I would have been concerned about not so much the lending side, but just the uncertainty when it came to deposits, because we had the regional banks, the stress that was happening there, and education to customers about what uninsured deposits were. We're right at 5% uninsured deposits.
So meaning, you know, 95% of your deposits are insured by the FDIC.
That's exactly right. And so most banks like mine are like that. So it's an education process. The confidence in the customers expressed in us was quite high, and we were just at the front of being transparent and open and just accessible through that kind of transition.
So you said you've never seen this before.
Never.
So how do you explain it?
I mean, there's still so much money out there, and there's so much optimism, even with the difficulty of having the inflationary pressures affecting families. I mean, that's happening, you know, with small businesses. But I think that there was just we couldn't hire, you know, fast enough because there wasn't the labor force there. And so small businesses didn't overcorrect that optimism. And so I think it's kind of kept things in check. We're seeing some small business stress. You've got to have a good business plan and good product to be successful. We're there for a period of time. It was kind of irrational exuberance.
Help me out though. When you say there's so much money out there, meaning what? Money for lent? Like, what do you mean by that?
There's a lot of investor money still out there that's okay. Either investing in real estate or buying businesses. A lot of M&A activities that's still occurring for small businesses. And so you just still see investor optimism out in the marketplace, not really thinking about the market, but really what's happening on the ground.
Hey, tell us more about the focus of your bank. It's single branch, employee owned in Edmond, Oklahoma. Who are your customers, and what are the segments that you're not just active in, but prominent in?
Yeah, so it's just your absolutely traditional community bank. If you watched It's a Wonderful Life, we're basically George
Bailey.
Kind of
feels so lovely against like the backdrop that we've grown into, but go ahead.
It is really interesting. So we have, our average deposit, our median deposit is right at $12,000. So very has small depositors.
Retail, this isn't business.
Small businesses small and business. Consumers.
Wow.
Okay. Very kind of equal on the deposit side. And then our lending, we do traditional mortgages as well as small business loans and commercial real estate.
On the mortgage side, with rates at roughly 7% for a mortgage right now, how have you seen it slow down locally?
Oh, it's come almost to a complete halt in some ways, but a lot of cash value buyers still out there. There's still people moving into town that still need to buy a home. But then when are you looking at rents availability, which has increased lately? It used to be really difficult just a year ago to get a house for rent. Now it's a little bit less expensive to do that and more accessible.
So your mortgage business is almost completely dried up?
Oh, yes. Yeah. The mortgage value business very low.
When do you think it'll, at what rate do you think it'll come back?
Yeah, I think whenever we're in the sixes, that really helps, you know, kind of momentum whenever you start
you
getting
people
into
walking
the sevens.
In when,
yeah.
When you're in the sixes.
But I think it's starting to normalize. I think the expectation has been like, well, we're around historic norms right now. And so I think realtors are starting to accept that and consumers are as well.
Hmm. What's the upside of being a bank like you are, right? That's kind of an anomaly, right? In a big bank kind of environment, certainly here in the New York Metro. But there's upsides and downsides to everything. What's the upside? What's the downside? Or how you think about competition, especially in the digital space where, you know, even someone who's got, you know, an actual brick and mortar, if you will, that you've got to compete with the digital space as well, especially for a younger generation.
Yeah, so it's such a great question. So we've been around for 122 years and our plan is to be here for another 100 years. And so we are so accountable to our customer base and that accessibility. I sit in our lobby, so customers come straight into my office. But whenever we're competing in the digital space, we just launched a digital bank for the military. And so this bank also, $350 million bank, we just received our first patent for a completely remote self-service bank. So just because you're small doesn't mean you can't be disruptively innovative.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because you are a U.S. Army veteran, mm-hmm. And a lot of your family, your husband served, your kids went to military academies and are serving. What are the unique needs from the military when it comes to financial services?
Yeah, so soldiers, a new soldier like I was, whenever I enlisted, many of them showed up unbanked, and that's still occurring. And they still are quite susceptible to predatory lending.
Because they were so young?
Yeah, so many banks won't open independent checking accounts for 17-year-olds. They have to bring their parents in. Many come from situations in which there's not a lot of financial literacy and support around them. So it's really their first job, and maybe the first job in their family in a couple of generations. So it's really a great opportunity for us, we think, to be able to really meet someone where they are, provide financial literacy around that, and really understand this young hero coming to serve their country. How can we support them best to get them on firm financial footing.
Can't agree. We have all these people who go fight to, you know, around the world for, you know, to defend democracy, defend freedom, and yet they're often left behind in so many different aspects of our society.
Yeah, we talk so much about after they serve too, Carol.
Healthcare, you know, financially, educationally, and then you're talking about banking. So tell us about how this platform will work and who will you open it to everyone?
Yes, it's open to everyone. It launched in August.
In the military, anybody?
Anybody in that qualifies for our bank account can open an account with us. It's a two-minute account opening. We're using alternative identification methods that typically aren't available in a digital bank. So if you have a tribal card, if you just have your military ID, sometimes you can't open accounts. And most digital banks in that method, it also gives them an instant direct deposit form signed by me that they can text to their recruiter. So while they're sitting there, they can open their account and not have to worry about transportation. Many of these young people don't have cars. They don't have a banking relationship. They're wanting to enlist, and so then they're having to leave and go to the bank to do that.
As you mentioned, you're more than a century-old bank, traditional bank. How do you compete with the venture-funded startups that are going after the same demographic?
Yeah, I view them as a lot of great, healthy competition, and many of us are really great friends, and we learn from each other. And so we partner with a lot of venture-funded startups that are in this business. I mean, the who we partnered with for our digital bank, that we're in that space. And so
because a lot of these are fintechs that are, they can't necessarily call themselves banks, but they partner with banks.
They do,
for financial services. So you've partnered with some of these fintechs?
I partner and I mentor many of them. I mean, we're cultivating that space because it's crucial to the longevity of a community bank that we have strong alliances with our fintech community.
We're talking about Jill Castilla. She's Citizens Bank of Edmond president and CEO here in studio with us. Jill, as you said, for Roger is the service, right? It's a digital bank offering for military members. You said for those who qualify, what's required? I'm thinking a 17-year-old, what's required for them to qualify? Because I do wonder how many will pass that qualification, how many will not?
Yeah, it's a very low barrier to entry. Is it? So basically, it's having a valid identification.
And that's it.
Yeah, and we also verify kind of where they are to make sure that it's not a fraudulent account. So
how do you make money on these accounts?
We have a motto, if we do good, we'll do well. And so the focus has been build something that is amazing, and then the financials take care of itself. I mean, that's what's great about
Are you charging for these accounts?
They're free accounts. There's no fees associated with them. We do a roundup and a match. We have a really nice, healthy interest rate on savings account. And so really the only way that you make money off of this type of account is through interchange revenue from the transactions.
So when somebody swipes their card,
so benign. We reimburse all foreign ATM fees. There's no user cost associated with this.
And where are you seeing the footprint right now of people adopting the accounts?
Yes, so it's widespread. We have them overseas. We have veterans that are living overseas. They're opening accounts, even though we're targeting that entry-level service member.
Do you have more people getting these accounts? They're not virtual accounts, but they're online only accounts.
Yeah.
Do you have more people who have these accounts than customers who are walking through the door of the branch?
We're opening them out at the same pace, but we have much more accounts in our physical branch than we do in this.
But eventually, you'll probably have more.
Yeah, I think it probably will. The ease and accessibility to be able to get banked. Where previously going into bank is so intimidating. Mm-hmm. I remember growing up and being intimidated going into a staunchy bank, and being able to reduce those barriers. It's good for everyone.
Do you remember the first time?
I actually remember my first, but it was interesting. It was
My parents brought me to open a checking account, and I had to be with them and. Yeah,
But you did. You had your family do it, right? And it was like
we had to sit down with somebody,
and it was your birthday money, or whatever, or you know, holiday money, and we started really early. What kind of breaks my heart is to hear you talk about these individuals who, you know, when you talk about being, you know, unbanked, if you will, it's often we're talking about emerging economies or something, right? And they're trying to figure it out, and often technology comes to the rescue.
Right, we're not talking about the U.S., right?
Right, we're not, and so it kind of breaks my heart that there are folks, it's not a new story and it shouldn't break my heart because I've heard it before, but that are just left behind individuals in the system.
Well, I was economically vulnerable when I enlisted, and then a family member wrote checks on my account while I was gone and took all that money, and that was 30 years ago.
Wow.
I shared that story and a young lady came up to me and said, that was me. And she was 18 years old and had just enlisted a year before and had to have her mom on her account when she opened the account, but the mom had a garnishment, so when the money posted in her bank account, it was taken. So this is a story that's gone on way too long. And so it's really, we feel like no one else is coming. They've had the chance to come and no one else is coming. So it's our job to fix it.
How many people do you have so far?
So we're right around about 1,000 that we're serving right now. And yeah. So we're really a small institution, so we don't have like the huge digital marketing push that other digital banks do. We're not VC funded, but we are seeing just great receptivity on an organic basis.
Community banks, a community bank, it's employee owned. We've seen so much consolidation in the last few years. I mean, in the last few decades in this space. Can you tell us that your bank will remain independent while you run it?
I would not be here if there was anywhere in the cards that we were thinking about not being independent. We feel like we have this kind of audacious thought that we'll lead the way for everyone else and show them how it's done. We want to be here another century.
Do you want to grow physical branches too?
I sold our physical branches, and just to have the one, and that's why we invented this other space, is because we had demand in another geography. Mm-hmm. So now customers can walk into our bank 24/7 in this little remote electronic banking facility with their phone, deposit up to $10,000 in cash, withdraw up to $10,000 in cash, get rolled coin, deposit loose coin, and conduct their banking transactions 24/7 integrated with our core. So it's like a small business ATM.
I have seen some of the big banks start to do that also.
Well, we have the patent.
Okay.
So maybe you might just warn them a little bit.
Okay. Did I done?
The exact same thing.
Just got about 30 seconds left here, Jill. I do think about, you know, the importance of community banks, right? What you see versus maybe, you know, what a big financial giant that is many miles away doesn't see.
Well, and I think we get lumped into the big regional banks when we think about all the small ones are ones that are less than the top 20, whenever there's 4,000 of us, less than a billion. We are here serving our communities every day. We're the ones supporting the little leagues, that we're in the grocery store aisles, accountable to our communities. So you don't need to worry about kind of what Wall Street's thoughts are on the bank, because you know what the bank is doing day in and day out. You see the loans that they're doing. You see if they're being responsible with their deposits, and you see how they're investing and building their communities.
Great stuff. Interesting. And come back and let us know how Roger's doing. It'd be interesting to see. Really fascinating. Jill Castillo, she is president and CEO of Citizens Bank of Edmond, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, TikTok, just about 18 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. Charlie, of course, breaking down the numbers. We're green across the screen when it comes to the U.S. equity trade, but we're definitely off our best levels of the session here. But you bring up the IPOs, the Reddit IPO, still up about just shy of 50% at $50, almost $51 a share. So really out of the gate, very strong in this first day of trade. And I'm just going to bring up Astera Labs, too, because I just want to go there. It's up about 11%. It's second day of trading, that after a gain, Tim, of more than 72% yesterday.
So what's the right, I don't know, train of thought on all this
I'm
stuff,
trying not
Carol?
To get
this
idea exuberant here.
That's a word that I think one could use to describe the markets. If we close at a record today on the S&P 500, we'll close for a 20th record.
Pretty remarkable
for the S&P. Really curious what Cheryl Smith has to say about this. She's economist and portfolio manager at Trillium Asset Management. She joins us from Boston, Massachusetts today. Cheryl, how are you?
I'm great today. How are you doing?
Oh, we're doing well. Hey, wondering what you think about the, I don't want to say exuberance, but I think it's fair to say that with some of the excitement that we're seeing in the IPO market, how does that look to you?
I think I'd go with a euphoria rather than exuberance, in the sense that we are very long in the tooth for this economic cycle. The equity market wants to believe and wants to believe hard and is looking for every possible sign to go higher. The fact is that we are 24 months into a Fed tightening cycle, and that is about when we normally see interest rate hikes begin to really affect the economy. I think we had a bit of a head fake last year during the regional bank crisis last March, and so everybody thought, oh, it's going to happen now. Oh, it didn't happen. It must not be going to happen. But we're seeing signs of softness in the labor market. We're seeing signs of softness in the credit market, and those are just the kinds of signs. What you see in a pre-recession environment is the market goes up and up and up, and then suddenly everyone wakes up and says, oh, wait, no, we shouldn't be doing that.
Are you
and
saying you that's where we are now?
I'm saying we're not at the drop yet. Okay. We're at the party.
But we are but you're saying, I guess it's, we could always say we're pre-recession because there's going to be a recession, but right?
It's true. Just okay. How many 10 years in advance, right?
Exactly. So where are we sort of in that cycle right now?
I would say we are seeing a lot of signs of softness in the labor market, and the couple of ticks up we saw in the household employment would indicate that we might fairly rapidly start seeing some declines in employment, and that would pretty quickly feed through to equity market valuation. So I'm thinking that we are 4 to maybe 6 months away from recession.
Wow. So hang on a second, because Jay Powell, Fed Chair, yesterday in his press conference and answering questions from reporters said that the labor market is in good shape. We monitor labor market carefully. I don't see cracks. So when he says something like that, you read that, and I love that you wear two hats, economist and portfolio manager. You got to put it all together, what the economic backdrop is and what does it mean for investing and investors. Having said that, when Jay Powell says that, do you not kind of read like, wait, he feels pretty confident, and maybe not just today, but longer term, or do you read that, well, he doesn't see the cracks right now?
With all due respect to the Fed chair, his job is not to cause the economy to go somewhere bad. So I think until cracks are quite visible, he does not want to be citing them. The cracks I see are, I wouldn't call them cracks, I would call it softness. We see softness in many of the state unemployment figures. We see, very patchy employment, with employment growing in Texas and Florida and some of the more southern states, and employment really not growing much across most of the coasts. We also are seeing, as I mentioned, that difference between the household employment and the new jobs added numbers. And that kind of divergence usually resolves in one direction or another. I'm thinking at 24 months into a credit hiking cycle,
okay,
we're going to be seeing that market slow down.
Forgive me, because I'm really interested in what you have to say. It just goes counter to so much of what we're hearing from so many of our guests right now. I think it's really interesting. We just spoke to Jill Castilla over at Citizens Bank of Edmond. She's the president and CEO, and she gave us an idea that and look, it's a small bank. It's only in one city, but she has a virtual bank too with about 1,000 customers. And she says essentially right now, for her customer, things have never been better.
And there's a lot of money sloshing
around. I can hear
around.
That that's her. I can hear that that's her experience.
Uh-huh.
But I would point out that credit card delinquencies are going up, that auto loan rates on for people in lower credit tiers are extremely high, and we're seeing a lot of dislocations in the CLO market. So there's just pockets. It's not widespread distress, but I see enough that concerns me. We want to be positioned, as you mentioned, I'm also a portfolio manager. We want to be positioned in companies with less leverage. We want to be positioned in companies that have a lot of financial cushion. We don't want to be out over the edge of a cresting wave.
So let's talk more about how customers should be positioned right now. Give us some idea of the types of companies, and if you can, the names of companies that people should be in right now.
Sure. Can't do names because compliance. as always.
Doesn't
However,
have to
what
ask.
I can talk about is the characteristics. Yes, characteristics that we're looking for. We're looking for companies with low leverage, low net debt. We're looking for companies that have a high return on invested capital, good ROA as well as ROE, not so much leverage between those two. We want companies that have a demonstrated ability to generate profit. So I would say in the steadier growth component, not the high growth area, but companies that in good markets and bad are able to do it. We're also looking at companies that are already seeing flows from the Inflation Reduction Act, from the net investment and infrastructure rebuilding. So the companies that are kind of on the front lines of that are companies that we want to be invested in.
Interesting. The IPOs too, tech ones, big ones in the last 2 days, coming out of the gate very strong. Does that give you, does that say something about the marketplace to you? And just got about 25 seconds. Does that give you some more optimism perhaps or no? Just quickly.
Hard to say. They seem a little frothy to me. I'm sorry.
No,
I'm an economist. We're dour. No, we're gloomy.
You know what? This is what makes a market.
Well, you're an economist and a portfolio manager, so you got to put it all together. Yeah. So I appreciate the takeaway. Cheryl Smith, thank you so much. Look forward to next time. Cheryl Smith, economist and portfolio manager at Trillium Asset Management.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.